Good morning. It's 6 after 9. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. Kathleen is back next week. Well, for years, southern China's coastal region has been the world's factory floor. Now, factory workers there are demanding better wages and working conditions. There have even been some strikes. And the Chinese government has finally started shifting its monetary policy, allowing its currency to appreciate. Could we be seeing the end of Made in China? Well, that's the question on our minds this hour. My guest is Barry Naughton, professor of Chinese economy at the University of California, San Diego, and the author of the book, The Chinese Economy, Transitions and Growth. Good morning, Professor, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, John. It's a delight to be here.
The genesis for this program was an AP News story, the headline of which was the end of Made in China, and that's what got us started. But we're going to have a general conversation about the Chinese economy, just truth in advertising there, and also for our callers so that when they call in, they're on the right topic. But we are seeing some changes in the Chinese economy, and let's talk about some of those. There's worker unrest in some of China's major manufacturing areas.
Yeah, there's tremendous changes taking place, and it's really exciting because the changes have an absolutely historical dimension. You know, if we look back over the past 20 years, China has developed this enormous export industry machine. Literally hundreds of millions of people have moved from the countryside into the coastal areas where most of the factories are. And during all that time, during this massive economic growth, the wages of the unskilled workers in the factories have scarcely increased. And the reason they've scarcely increased is simply because there are so many people available. When this process started, we estimate there were something like 300-350 million workers in Chinese agriculture, in the countryside, working on farms, but who were willing to leave as long as they had the prospect of a job. And so this process just went on for decades as this pool of rural surplus labor was gradually drawn down. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, we started to see signs that in order to attract people to more factory jobs, the employers had to improve working conditions a little bit. They had to kick up the wages a little bit. In other words, they had to compete for new workers. Now, at first, they didn't have to compete very hard, but still, there was some progress. And then, 2 years ago, not quite, the global financial crisis hit. And it seemed as if all this had been turned around because suddenly there weren't enough jobs to go around. And Chinese workers typically go home to their villages on Chinese New Year. Almost everybody does. It's this a great tradition where you have to settle up your debts with your neighbors and friends in the village over the Chinese New Year holiday. And in the Chinese New Year of 2009, an estimated something like 20 million workers went home and decided to stay. Now, this was sort of good news, bad news. The good news was they had some place to stay. People who lost their jobs in the coastal factories, still typically their families still have land back in the village. They have a kind of a cushion social safety net. So the worst impact of the global crisis on China a year and a half ago was buffered by this. But then something even more amazing happened. Is during the course of 2009, the Chinese government started up new construction projects. A lot of the factories sort of stabilized and rehired some of the people they had let off. And most of the people who had planned to stay in the countryside started filtering back to the city again. And by the end of 2009, so that's not very long ago now, of course, by the end of 2009, these people were working again. And the pattern that we saw before clearly reasserted itself very, very quickly. In other words, wages clearly started to go up, even for the unskilled kid, the girl, 17-year-old, coming from the village, coming to work in a factory in the Pearl River Delta where she's sewing clothes or assembling microelectronics. The wages for that girl started to go up. So it's a remarkable historical turnaround. I sort of think of it in terms of the words that Winston Churchill used a long time ago. It's not the end. It's not the beginning of the end. But it might indeed be the end of the beginning, in the sense that it marks a turning point where China is beginning to move away from being the vast workshop of the world where all this low-skilled labor is concentrated in Chinese rural areas along the coast.
Well, there would be pluses and minuses to that. I mean, good and bad both. I would think that if Chinese workers are making more money, they would actually be able to be the market for a lot of Chinese goods, maybe things they couldn't afford before.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, for me, of course, I have the luxury of looking at it from a distance over the long term. It's tremendously positive. This really marks the fact that China is moving out of this overall stage where most people are poor and into a status where, of course, there's still a significant poverty problem, but where the society as a whole is inching into some kind of middle-class status. So I think overall it's definitely a good thing. Now, obviously, if you're an export factory, if you're the manager of that factory, your life just got considerably more difficult because you've been used to being able to tell people what to do and having them jump all the time because there was always somebody else who would do their job if they didn't want to do it the way you wanted them to. And that's changing. Now, of course, it's still got a long way to go. Life in a Chinese electronics factory is still tough, low pay, long hours, but at least the process has started.
Now, there have been a lot of news stories about the Chinese economy recently. One that I noted said that a number of companies are shifting their factories to cheaper areas further inland. Instead of just being on the southern coast, where a lot of the factories have been located, they're moving inland, going after untapped workforces. Apparently,
yeah, that's right. I mean, if you think about China, of course, it's very rugged, so transportation is relatively expensive, and that has kept most of the export manufacturing right along the coast until very, very recently. But a couple of things have happened. Of course, first, this change in labor conditions. Second, the Chinese government has been pouring money into infrastructure for about 10 years now. So they've now got an expressway network built up through most of the country. It's astonishing. They have almost as much expressway in China today as we do in the United States. So areas that used to be prohibitively expensive to ship goods in and out of are now becoming, of course, there's still a cost differential, but it's not huge. And if you think about your sense of China, you know, recall that there's a mountainous area in the west and the province of Sichuan, and it's a rich basin, a rich agricultural basin. It's got 120 million people live there. It's completely surrounded by mountains. That's where the Yangtze River flowing out of Sichuan flows through the Three Gorges, where that huge dam is and where there's been flooding in the last few weeks. But that area, you know, 120 million people, I mean, that's, of course, bigger than all but the biggest countries. That's a huge potential manufacturing base. If you can produce the export goods there, you can ship them down the Yangtze out to world markets. So we definitely see movement to those parts of inland, the densely populated, not as rich as the coastal areas have become, and areas that are sort of moving up the ladder as they also enter the export game.
We had someone call in, and we're already getting calls. I haven't even given the phone number yet. I'll do that in just a moment. But we had a caller who put the question to us, does Rolls-Royce sell more cars in the U.S. or China? I think the implication has to do with the rise of wealth in China. Do you know?
Yeah, I don't know that specific one. It could well be. There are certainly many things like that. Because, you know, when you think about it, this process, you've got all these workers coming into the factory. Their wages haven't changed much over 20 years. Well, during that 20 years, my God, the size of the Chinese economy has more than quadrupled. The people who are running these factories have indeed gotten rich. So the market for luxury goods in China is quite substantial. The aggregate total size of the luxury market in China is certainly not as big as in the U.S., but it's most people think It's number three, catching up quickly with Japan. So, you know, businessmen certainly are reasonable to get excited about the potential for selling Mercedes and Rolls Royces in China. And I must say, I've seen some cars in China that I've never seen in Southern California. Lamborghinis and lots of expensive prestige cars. But, of course, along with this, it means that the income inequality in society has gotten much, much worse over this 20, 25-year period. Because as the, you know, as a very large class of people have gained only modestly from this huge economic boom, there are large groups that have gained and a very small group that has gained extraordinary income advances. So there's tension in the society about this very rapid increase in inequality.
Well, and there's to me, there seems to be an irony here, since the government of China is still, at least on the surface, communist.
Absolutely. It's definitely an irony, and even more than an irony, right? Because it's a deep contradiction. I mean, on the one hand, the Chinese Communist Party is so wedded to these business interests, and to some extent, multinational business interests, but much more importantly, Chinese domestic business interests. The politicians are tied with these business interests in a web of deal-making, corruption, and development, all tied together. The Communist Party leaders are so closely linked to real estate developers in most towns that you can hardly tell one from the other. So it goes beyond irony and becomes hypocrisy in many, many different levels. On the other hand, they still claim to be a party that acts in the interests of the whole society. And their own legitimacy has been cracked by this close relationship, which everybody sees, between the party people and money. So that means that the current leaders, the party leader, Hu Jintao, and the government leader, Wen Jiabao, remember they have both of these hierarchies intertwined. I mean, everybody understands that the party is the ultimate ruler, but certain functions are done by the government and certain functions are done by the party. And they very much, when they came in around 2003, they very much announced a new political agenda. You know, they said, we're going to adopt policies that work for the benefit of the poorer people of society, the disadvantaged people of society. Of course, they're not going to work against the advantages of the better-off people, because the better-off people are they themselves. But to their credit, they have implemented a series of policies that make farmers somewhat better off, and they've actually started to provide some kind of moderate support for labor organizers and labor rights within the factories of China in the cities themselves. Especially, of course, the factories of foreign companies, much less so the factories of Chinese domestic companies. But we actually see the government giving lukewarm and passive, but still nonetheless real, support for workers in these export factories who are beginning to organize for higher wages and better working conditions. And that is something that's almost as dramatically new as as some of the economic changes that I was talking about at the beginning.
Well, I want to pursue that a little bit more, Professor, in just a moment, but I need to give the phone numbers and give people a chance to join us. 800-642-1234. That's the number to call, 800-642-1234. And you can also reach us via email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And there's a Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page. You can go there and leave a comment as well. We'll share it with the listening audience. We're talking about China, the Chinese economy. Is this the end of Made in China? Are economic changes happening there going to open the door to other countries to get in on manufacturing because they can do it cheaper than the Chinese? Is the cost of labor going up? What about the fluctuations now in the Chinese currency? What about that? Well, we'll talk about all of those things, and we'll take your questions and thoughts as well as we continue. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 22 minutes after 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on today. After 3 o'clock on Here on Earth, Jean Faraca and her guests discuss the history and cultural diversity of the idea of heaven. That's after 3 o'clock this afternoon, here on Earth, Radio Without Borders with Jean Faraca. This hour, we're talking about the economy in China and changes that are happening there with Barry Naughton, professor of Chinese economy at the University of California, San Diego, and the author of The Chinese Economy, Transitions and Growth. Well, Professor, just before that break, we were talking about labor and how labor seems to be organizing now. And again, that to me, organized labor in an ostensibly communist country is kind of seems like it. Well, at least it ought to be an oxymoron. But we're seeing strikes. We're seeing worker calls for higher wages. We're seeing some labor unrest in China. What will the outcome of this be? And what is the official position of the government on the idea of workers organizing?
Well, of course, the official Chinese government position on almost everything is a little bit of it is okay as long as we control it. Now, for a worker organization, of course, they've always had a national trade union, and most workers were supposed to be members of it. And the problem was just that the trade union never did anything. It was so obviously subservient to these interest cliques that we were talking about earlier, that it was just a completely neutered, almost fake organization. And what's happened in the last several years is that this organization has begun to show some signs of life, especially with regard to foreign-owned businesses. It's no accident, I don't think, that the first couple of cases where we see out-and-out strikes, you know, clear collective action and a collective bargaining component, have all been against Japanese factories in Guangdong province in China's south. You know, there's a special edge to the China-Japan relationship. Relations have been a little bit better lately, but still there's there's a definite friction and a sense of competition between the two countries. So the fact that the labor union has, in essence, been given the go-ahead to overtly press the Honda company in particular, it's not accidental. But at the same time, the government is very, very aware that actions have demonstration effects, and especially actions that are publicized in the official press, as these ones have been. You know, they understand very well that workers in other factories, including in domestic factories, domestically owned factories, will see this and go, well, wait, if they have this right and this is publicized in the government press, then we must have this right as well. And so there is the government is saying for the first time, it hasn't made an official pronouncement, but you start to see in the press discussions of the fact that all workers in Guangdong province, now this is the province near Hong Kong that is the largest single source of export commodities, you start to see discussions of the fact that all workers in Guangdong province should have collective bargaining arrangements within the next unspecified period, probably about 5 years. So very, very different political dynamic going along with the changed economic conditions.
Well, it's a fascinating story, which is one of the reasons we want to talk about it, because boring radio programs don't do us much good. Let's go to the phones. People have an interest in this topic and have things to say, and let's hear what it is. James is on the road. James, good morning. Thanks for holding.
Give me a little background. I'm 70, in my 70s now and retired, but I've seen numerous plants move out of the United States into China, and the only and the professor is right on. I mean, he's right. He's exactly right about China. The only thing that the workers can do, they had to have government approval to do this. But the only thing I wish to when the topic of that, get more specific about the wages and the benefits over there. The wages in China were 70 cents an hour in the early and late 90s, and now they're about a buck an hour, and the workers are striking, according to the information that we get through our newsletter, for an extra 50 cents an hour, which would make their wages go to a buck, that dollar and a half an hour. And I just wish that when we had these discussions so the American people could know that the Chinese individuals still can't buy what they produce over there at a buck at $200 a month or whatever their wages would be, and that's the reason that these trade agreements with these countries will not work. That we ship our $20 jobs to the Mexico and China that make $3 an hour and a dollar an hour, and is. It has to be brought to light and has to be discussed, and I really appreciate the conversation on this topic. Thank you very much for having it.
Thanks for the call, James. Professor, care to comment on what James had to say?
Sure, absolutely. I think, first of all, his numbers are excellent. He's obviously knows a great deal about this topic. So it's true that the average in fact, in many ways, it makes sense to think of the average worker in this factory as, say, a 19-year-old girl who lives in a dormitory. Not only does she make the wages about what James said, but she's probably saving about 40% of it and sending it back to her family in the village. So it's absolutely right. She is consuming very little. And one of the reasons why there's friction between China and the United States about exchange rate policy is because China does have a very large surplus, not only with the United States. That's sort of no surprise there. Everybody has a big surplus with the United States. But China, since 2006, has had a big surplus with the world. And, of course, the U.S. government, and in this I think the U.S. government is absolutely right, is saying to the Chinese, you should allow your currency to increase in value more rapidly. That way, the people in your economy will have more purchasing power, especially if we get into this phase where wages are inching up and currency is appreciating. You know, you could easily imagine a scenario where that $1.50, now that doesn't seem like much, and it isn't much. I mean, I'm not trying to prettify it. $1.50 an hour, that's not much money. It's certainly a lot more than that 19-year-old girl was ever making in the village. But if now we start talking about 20 and 30% wage increases, and we think of the currency going up 10 or 20%, you know, that then quickly over a couple of years, that wage can double in American dollar terms. That starts to have a much more substantial advantage in terms of the buying power of the Chinese consumer, which is what we want to see. The funny thing is the Chinese government claims that it's what it wants to see, but it is so cautious and so, you know, in some ways it likes to have this big trade surplus, and it likes to have this gigantic pool of money from the foreign exchange reserve, which is piled up. So it's been letting their currency appreciate, but so slowly, it's just very, very frustrating.
The number that I saw from Bloomberg this morning was that the yuan had risen 0.8% against the dollar in since, what was it, June, I think, 20th or so, when they first started to allow it to appreciate.
But the fact that they're allowing that was in the first couple of days.
Yeah, the fact that they're doing it at all, though, is certainly progress. I mean, the United States has been bugging China about its monetary policy for years.
It's definitely progress, and if we could sustain a pace, that pace, then we'd be fine. In other words, if the Chinese currency were appreciating about 1% per month, then we'd be in good long-term position, because with the combination of wage increases and a 1% per month appreciation, would gradually drive China's trade into balance over about 2 years, and that would be fine. The other thing we need to keep in mind is that over the crisis period, it'd be nice to think we're done with the crisis period. I think that's not quite true yet, but during the worst part of the crisis period, China and the U.S. were very much aligned by both pumping demand into our economies. And China really, Chinese government stepped up construction projects and created an enormous burst of demand. So during 2009, their imports were increasing very, very rapidly. So although we'd like to see them do more, for sure, if we look backwards over the last, say, 2 years, they've been a pretty positive force in the global economy.
Well, for better or worse, the United States and China are pretty heavily engaged. The Chinese hold a lot of our paper.
They sure do. They've got $2.4 trillion worth of foreign exchange reserves, which might be enough for anybody.
Yeah, I would imagine. Let's see. Thanks, James, for that call. James is on the road. James, stay safe out there. Claire in Mount Horeb, you'll be next. Claire, good morning.
Good morning. I've got two questions for your guest. And the first is that your guest mentioned that the Guangdong province, where a lot of these factories are right across the border from Hong Kong. I last year visited a former factory in the Kowloon district. It was a shoe factory. It's now a museum that shows what the manufacturing used to be in Hong Kong. And then when the Chinese economy opened up for manufacturing, all those jobs moved into Guangdong province right across the border. And Hong Kong is now more of a service economy, and it's real big with tourism. So my question is, what do you see for Guangdong province when those jobs move away to the interior? And then I also have another question.
Okay. So I'll start with the first question then. First of all, for Guangdong, this process is going to take a long time. And what Guangdong wants very clearly is to turn into a hub of high-tech manufacturing. They're already the biggest producer of desktop computers in the world by a long shot. And so their hope is not to turn into a service economy like Hong Kong, but to turn into a different kind of manufacturing economy. So they'll lose the shoes, lose the garments, but keep the computers and other kinds of high-tech manufacturing. In the process, if that's successful, what we think will go along with that will be an overall decline in the share of manufacturing and the growth of a much more sophisticated service sector. So probably Guangzhou or Canton will continue to rise in influence and become kind of a twin city with Hong Kong, with Guangzhou handling more of the producer services, more of the manufacturing-related services, while Hong Kong stays the financial hub. But that, of course, is the good trajectory over sort of 20 to 30 years.
And what was your second question, Claire?
Oh, thanks. My second question is, my daughter is going to be working in Yunnan province for the next year or two with an NGO that trains people from the rural areas not to work in factories but to work in the tourist industry, especially near Tibet, which is where apparently there's a real rise in tourism. And when she was there the first time, she said there was a big increase in tourism just within China with an increased number of Chinese citizens that have enough money to travel. And so I'm wondering what he's thinking about the growth in the tourist industry in China.
Yeah, absolutely. It's huge. And as a Western tourist, you can't help but regret a little bit of it, because there are so many fascinating places in China that you used to be able to go and there weren't very many people there, and now they're often quite crowded, and the crowds are composed of Chinese domestic tourists who are delighted to have this opportunity now to travel places, the freedom economically and politically to wander around and visit lots of different parts of China. So it's definitely a major contributor to the economy and a big growth industry within China.
Claire, thanks for those questions. Let's go next to Beloit and talk with John. John, good morning.
Hi. I teach politics at Beloit College, and I wonder if we have it underrated here when you talk about the infrastructure spending. how much of that has been wasted to government corruption, not just central but local governments and state-owned businesses? And is there going to be a huge bubble here, state-owned banks loaning money to these entities and without expecting being paid back? And could this lead to one of the greatest property bubbles of all time pretty soon?
That's a great question, and as you know, it's something that's sort of much discussed and much debated in the China economics community. And one of the reasons people are concerned a lot about it is because the speed with which the Chinese rolled out their stimulus program at the end of 2008 and especially the first half of 2009 was just mind-boggling. I mean, I myself was very surprised. I did not project that they could move so quickly on such a massive scale. So, I mean, we literally saw the Chinese launch a stimulus program, and within 6 weeks, we could see construction activity picking up and people working on different projects throughout the country. So, naturally, that leads us a little suspicious. Well, wait a minute. If they're moving that fast, surely these projects must be lower quality, thrown together, and possibly very corrupt, as the caller, as John indicated. So, so we definitely worry about this. So far, though, the indications are that it doesn't seem, particularly bad. It seems that one of the things about the Chinese economy. So there are two sort of political features of the Chinese economy that seem to play into this. One, of course, is it's an authoritarian system, very top-down. And so when the top said jump, people jumped. That's part of the reason the response was so quick. But the second part is it's a society that's obsessed with development and economic growth. So when we do case studies of some of the local governments that responded to this program, they have a shelf of projects that they want to do at any given time that were sort of sitting there already ready to go, and they were just waiting. When are we going to get the money? When are we going to get the permission? So all of a sudden, the central government said, essentially said to everybody, now, do it. And they really could, go up and pull a project off the shelf and say, get going, let's do it. So far, the quality of the projects doesn't seem to be terrible. Now, obviously, there are going to be problems that are going to come out that are hidden now that we don't know about. But it seems as if we have to predict the future, it looks like there will be some problems, but they're already taking steps to deal with it. They seem to be pretty much on top of this particular issue. So I think they're probably going to come out of this okay. They did kind of clamp down on the housing market starting about 3 months ago, because there was clearly a bubble there. But
There's a story that came out from Bloomberg. Again, this was yesterday that says China's regulators are bracing for home price declines of as much as 60%. So there has been a little bit of a real estate bubble in China, but they got into the speculation game as much as anybody else did.
But the difference is they're speculating with their own money and not so much the bank's money. Chinese savers don't have very many outlets, and so it's very popular for people to buy apartments and use that as a way of diversifying your asset base. And of course, if we do have corrupt rich classes, of course they need assets to diversify their wealth. So they want the housing price in the biggest cities to come down by about 20%, and they believe that will be a healthier market outcome, and that their banks will be fine if housing prices come down 20%. The 60% was part of a series of stress tests they did for their banks to see what would happen. Just look at the hypothetical: what would happen to our banks if housing prices collapsed, which really nobody expects.
Well, there's still demand.
There's still lots and lots of demand.
Yeah, and
so expectations are still. I mean, in a way, what's happening right now is the government says, we'd like to see house prices stabilize and even go down 10 to 20%. And the developers, the people who own these massive apartment complexes that they're they want to sell apartment by apartment, are essentially saying, well, we don't really believe you that prices are going to go down. In fact, we think they won't grow as rapidly as they have the last 6 months, but they're still going to appreciate. And, you know, there's a kind of standoff right now as buyers and sellers look at each other and try and figure out, you know, what the right price is for apartments going right now.
We're talking about the Chinese economy today. The genesis of the program was an AP story that suggested we were seeing the end of Made in China. That was probably a bit of hyperbole. But we're talking about the Chinese economy in general and the changes that it is going through. My guest is Barry Naughton, professor of Chinese economy at the University of California, San Diego, and the author of the book, The Chinese Economy Transitions and Growth. We have more calls coming. There's a line available for you if you want to join us pretty soon, 800-642-1234. Emails are also welcome. I've got one of those in the queue, and I'll be sharing that right after we take a little break. And we'll have more with our guest and with you in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 9:44. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. Next hour, we'll be talking about the events of December 29, 1890, when American troops opened fire on unarmed Sioux men, women, and children near Wounded Knee Creek in South Dakota, killing as many as 300. My guest and I will talk about the political forces that led up to the massacre at Wounded Knee. That's coming up next hour here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about the Chinese economy with Barry Naughton, professor of Chinese economy, Sok Wan Lok, chair of Chinese international affairs at the University of California, San Diego, and author of the book, The Chinese Economy Transitions and Growth. We had an email, Professor. I want to share that before we go any further. Brian sends this email. Free trade results in Chinese wages going up while American wages stagnate or go down until an equilibrium is reached. This is good for China, but terrible for the American worker. Also, China extracts tariffs of 23%, yet our tariffs on their stuff is only 2 to 3%. This is disastrous for American industry. Plenty to chew on there.
Yeah, well, there's certainly an element of truth, which is that in sectors where we compete directly with the Chinese, there is a tendency for our wages to get pushed down and Chinese wages to get pushed up. That's true. On the other hand, you know, the other side to that is that there are mutual gains in the areas where we exchange products in which we have advantage for products in which the Chinese have an advantage. The kind of things that we've been talking about today, the garments, the shoes, really the U.S. doesn't produce that very much anymore. So we're talking really about Chinese competitiveness with Vietnam and Bangladesh for garments in particular and other developing countries for lots of other labor-intensive manufacturers. So, you know, personally, I think it's a good thing if very, very poor people in Cambodia, say, and China are brought into the world economy in this way. American workers, you know, definitely, obviously, during the last 30 years, stagnation of wages in American factories is a big problem. Trade might be a contributing factor. But really what we see much more powerfully is new technologies that reduce the requirement for unskilled labor input. I mean, if you go into a car factory today, it's not the same as a car factory 20 or 30 years ago. And, you know, you don't really hear people saying, oh, technology is reducing unskilled labor wages, so we should stop technological progress. So I think, you know, it's a web of things that we're tied together in, and there are definitely costs, but I think overall the benefits do outweigh the costs. China's tariff schedule is sometimes different from ours, but it's not really higher than ours. But we do have a big problem with a set of Chinese policies that are that go under the heading of fostering indigenous innovation. innovation. This is the latest sort of buzzword in China. Now, for us, it's a problem precisely because the area where we've traditionally had a very strong advantage vis-a-vis the Chinese is, of course, in high technology products. And we have a very powerful exchange with China. If you just think of a laptop computer, you know, of course, Intel inside, right? The key high-tech component there is a Intel central processing unit. It's made in the United States. That is then shipped over to Asia. Taiwan, Korea, and Japan all produce components. And then everything gets put together in China. So the laptop ends up coming out of China back to the United States. Those flows are really complicated, but there's a very clear division of labor, and the U.S. occupies the highest tech niches. Well, the U.S., along with Japan, occupies the highest tech niches. Now, as China sort of moves out of this labor-intensive phase, for all the reasons we've been talking about in this hour, it wants to move into the high-tech phase. And this is the area where currently we're seeing, you know, serious policy conflicts between the United States and the big multinational companies that have been China's biggest defenders up until this point. So a company like General Electric, which does a huge amount of business in China, you know, selling things like turbines for airplanes, components to nuclear power plants, all kinds of things that that the Chinese want, is now feeling increasingly pressured by Chinese requirements, not so much requirements, Chinese policies that give preference to domestic suppliers on the grounds that they need to support domestic technology. It's this, more than tariffs or trade barriers of the standard sort, that really has American companies upset right now, and it's a key focus of China-U.S. tensions. And it's funny because you know, the political force behind what the Chinese are doing is very strong. In other words, this is an area where ordinary people like the policies, and government leaders like them because, of course, the government leaders are tied to the same domestic businesses that that we also talked about earlier in the program. So, you know, Chinese students who might be quite critical of their government in other ways are often strong supporters of these domestic technology innovation programs. So it's an area where there's a lot of friction right now, and it's not going away. It's going to be a big issue between the countries over the next couple, 3 years.
Let's take a call from Milwaukee. We'll talk to Hugh next. Hugh, good morning.
Hello. One of the things I don't think you're talking about enough is that how bad things were under Mao, when they tried to impose communism and the Cultural Revolution, and you know, one disaster after another, and that people who are old enough to have lived through and suffered through those decades, see the wondrous things that have happened in the past two decades. It may be a one-party dictatorship. It may be called the Communist Party. But they have allowed business and creativity to thrive. And the result, when I went, I was expecting to see a million bicycles, and I did. But I also saw BMWs and Volvos and Buicks and, all kinds of automobiles. In fact, there was no room for them. They often, not often, but sometimes they actually drove on the sidewalks. There may be strikes at the moment in southern China, but as you pointed out, these are starting with the Japanese companies, and of course the Japanese are not well liked in China. They're still running, like we still have, anti-German films as part of our repertoire on television and the movies. They have the anti-Japanese films from World War II, and Japanese are not very popular. But the other side is there are still many, many people who come from the countryside who need jobs. There are so many people. If you go to a supermarket, there'll be many young girls blocking the aisles trying to sell you things. You can barely get by because they're paid just piddling wages. restaurants, the people who work there, line up in military fashion in their little uniforms and get their commands of the day. There is a surplus of labor, and university graduates, I think 10 to 20% can find jobs. Hello?
Yeah. Yep, you're still there.
Absolutely. So one of the things about China is it's this massive process of change, of course. So, where do we start? Where do we grab a hold of it? And, of course, we've been talking about one set of issues that are very prominent in the Chinese economy today. And, the caller has very rightly brought in some of these other enormous dimensions to this society in massive change. So it's absolutely right. I mean, there is massive cultural change. The Chinese talk about the post-1980 generation, by which they mean, in essence, young people who weren't scarred psychologically by the Mao period. Young people who've grown up always having had things and not being scared about political movements or serious privation and things like that, because they recognize so clearly that the people who lived through the Cultural Revolution or the even worse greatly forward famine before that, were scarred for life and were cautious and timid for life, and now there's a whole new generation that isn't. And so one of the things about China that's so paradoxical is that, just as everyone predicted, society has become much more diverse, much more interesting, much healthier, much more competitive, much more open to new ideas. And as very few people predicted, the Communist Party has managed to hold on and solidify its authoritarian system at the same time that society has undergone this massive change. It's one of the most remarkable things in the world that we see today, is the way that China has combined this political control with massive social liberalization. But there it is.
Thanks for the call, Hugh. I appreciate it. Paul in West Bend, you'll be next. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. Just two comments, and if you could respond to them. Number one is the Chinese think tanks have done a profit profile, say, for example, on an iPhone or an iPad, and they see that the profits are going to the Western distributors and the marketeers, and they, the primary manufacturer, really are on the low end of the profit profile of any particular item. So they're going to look at branding, and branding is the name of the game if you're selling globally. That's the first comment. And what do you think? How that will affect our the economy here in this country. The next one is resource wars. I mean, if you got 1.3 billion plus people, and if you're ratcheting them up into a low middle income and middle income, clearly there's going to be a shortage of primary metals, timber, et cetera, et cetera. And how do you think that's going to play out in the next
okay.
decade?
All right, Professor, we're in the last 90 seconds of the program, so do your best.
All right. So first question, absolutely right. China's in the low end of those chains, but it's not just brands, right? Brands reflect the design and technological capabilities of a country like a company like Apple, right? Apple's great design, and some of the guts are from great Japanese and American and Taiwan technology companies. It's going to take China a while to catch up with that. Resource wars, both sides have ambitious plans for saving energy and reducing carbon. We haven't been able to agree on implementing them, but hopefully we get a new burst of movement in the next couple of years. So I'm a little bit more optimistic than the caller on that front.
Well, and I was going to mention in response, just to follow up on what one of our previous callers, or perhaps it was an emailer, had to say, the news stories now are carrying, some of the stories talk about companies that are moving back to the United States because it's actually cheaper to manufacture some things here than it is in China.
There are definitely a few cases of that. Not very many yet, though.
Well, but I mean, it is, you know, it does show that sometimes the more things change, the more they stay the same. I don't know.
That's absolutely right.
Professor, I know that we could do another hour. We could probably do several hours. China is such a huge, huge topic, and we didn't do it justice here. I'd love to talk with you again about this sometime.
I look forward to it. It's been my privilege talking to you.
Thank you very much. Barry Naughton, Professor of Chinese Economy, Suk Wun Lok, Chair of Chinese International Affairs at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of the book, The Chinese Economy, Transitions and Growth. Chrissy Pease produced this program. Dave Potras and Rhonda Fanning handled on-air production for me this morning. If you'd like to hear the program again, if you got in on it a little bit late, you can do that by going to our website, WPR.org. Go to the Kathleen Dunn page on the WPR website, and you can listen to any of Kathleen's programs there, including this one. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. Stick around, more after the news. We'll talk about the political aspects of the massacre at Wounded Knee, December 1890. Stay tuned.